Well, this work has severe consequences for women. As our work is starting to get more attention in the media, I've often heard comments to some of these articles like, oh, well, so what if a woman has to go get cake and make coffee? This is no big deal. But what we found in one study is that women in an organization were spending 200 more hours per year than men on non-promotable work.
Oh my gosh.
200 more hours. Okay. And so what this adds up to is something we call work-work imbalance. So you've heard of work-life imbalance, but work-work imbalance is the balance between the kinds of work you do at work that is promotable and non-promotable. And when women's work-work balance is imbalanced, she's doing too much non-promotable work and not enough promotable work. And that has really severe implications for women.
That was Linda Babcock, professor of economics at Carnegie Mellon, best-selling author of several negotiation books, and the author of her most recent book released in May, The No Club, Putting a Stop to Women's Dead-End Work. It's about how men and women spend their time while in their workplace. Hello, everyone. I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Just a quick note before we get started. Registration is now open for all three of our fall conferences. We're offering both in-person and online conference experiences this year at the Pennsylvania, Texas, and Massachusetts Conferences for Women. We so hope you'll join us to hear from just incredible and visionary voices, people like Brené Brown, Reese Witherspoon, Malala Yousafzai, Yara Shahidi, and many, many more. You can get more details at conferencesforwomen.org. Now, today's episode explores why women are overcommitted, underutilized, and often trapped in a spiral of toxic productivity. Professor, women's empowerment researcher, and best-selling author Linda Babcock has a lot of doable strategies and tangible tactics that can help you cut down on workload overload and create effective boundaries. They also might leave you feeling a little more empowered so that you can say no to non-promotable work and yes to work that leads to advancement. So let's get started.
Can we start just by this question of solving gender gaps in wages, in salaries, but also in the tasks that we do, the work that we're assigned, and who is sort of responsible for that? And that question comes from this idea that for a very long time, these gaps between the genders, we've been told that the solution is that women need to change, that women need to fix themselves, act more like men. What's your answer to that?
Yeah, it's a great question, really important question. We've been focused in organizations for so long on how to improve equity in the workplace. And we've tried a lot of different things. You know, there have been a lot of programs that have focused on, as you say, fix the women. Some of my research has been a part of that in looking at negotiation. Or maybe women need mentoring, they need sponsoring, they need special training. And all in all, it's been pretty unsatisfactory in terms of it hasn't helped move the needle.
Yeah.
And so the new research that we're focused on is really looking at how men and women spend their time at work, because of course, that is an input into everything. It's an input into how you're going to advance to your salary, and is one of the things that we think has really been hiding in plain sight and requires an organizational solution rather than something that women need to change.
So when you say organizational solution, what does that mean in terms of, look, let me put it more blatantly here, so much that has to do with either gender differences or racial differences, or really any gap of achievement, salary, whatever it may be, that can be traced back to identity. So often those initiatives don't make it past the executive level. For one reason or another, the sort of radical or sometimes revolutionary changes that have to be made don't get made because there's an executive reason, a good reason why they shouldn't be made. So when you talk about organizational solutions, what is it that you mean?
Well, these are solutions, and I can understand the perspective you just laid out, is that sometimes the problems that we're trying to solve don't have easy solutions. You know, you think about implicit bias, right? How do you stop people from having biases? Well, it turns out that's pretty hard. And so we have the ideas about what the problem is, but we don't really have easy and inexpensive solutions. And as you say, there's always a reason why, well, we can't do that. We can't implement that. What we're talking about here is not rocket science. It's actually really easy, and it's very easy to change. And it goes back to the kinds of work that men versus women are assigned to do and asked to do. And what we find in our research is that women are more likely to be asked and say yes to work that advances the organization but doesn't help their careers. And we call this non-promotable work. And our organizations are asking us to do this. We feel as women like we have to say yes because the expectation is that we'll say yes. So this work is being done by women, and it's really an anchor that's holding them back. And so what we need to do as a solution is to change the way that work is assigned. And actually, that's not that hard. You know, instead of asking for volunteers to do something that no one wants to do, draw names out of a hat, rotate who does the task. This isn't difficult to implement, and it's in organizations' interest to do so, not only because they are going to finally see the diversity, equity, and inclusion goals that they would like to see as a result of changing the way our work is allocated, but also it is dragging organizations down for women to be doing this work. So let me give you an example. If you have someone that's technically trained and you're having them do a lot of work that just about anyone in the organization can do, it's not a good use of resources. So I came across a woman who is a database analyst, and we talk about her in the book, Maria. And rather than spending her days writing complex algorithms, she was tasked to do a lot of administrative work. She sat on company-wide committees. She organized birthday events. She took notes at meetings. And that was not a good use of her time. It made her unhappy. It dragged her career down, and it wasted the organization's talent. And so they would have been better off assigning that to someone who hadn't spent years getting that technical training, and they could have done the work more efficiently. And so this is something that organizations should want to change, and it will help them achieve their equity goals.
Can you give me an example of other, you've mentioned a couple tasks that you're talking about, and in your research, it looks like they're called tasks with low promotability. I assume that means tasks that don't lead to a promotion. But can you give me an example of what they are?
Yeah, I know it's a mouthful, non-promotable tasks. But we think it's a lot better than the term that's often used, is, and that term is office housework, because it's not really housework. And some of it is very meaningful to the organization. So for example, we talked to a bartender, and you might think, well, what non-promotable tasks are there that bartenders have? Well, in this case, this bartender worked at a bar and grill, and every time they hired somebody new to work behind the bar, the owner had her train the new person. Mm. And when you train someone, you're not going to be serving in as many drinks. And how does she make money? She makes money from tips. And so every time she did the training, she was sacrificing some of her income for the good of the organization. Okay. And so, well, it's not promotable in the sense, we use the term very broadly to refer to anything that will help you achieve your work goals, whether that be income, a promotion, training. It's really standing in their way of achieving those goals. And so for the bartender, training new bartenders was non-promotable. She did not get rewarded for it. In fact, she was punished in terms of having less tips that evening when she did the training.
So some of these things that occurs to me immediately, a friend of mine is a science director at the National Institute of Health. She keeps getting asked to serve on hiring committees, which again, as you say, are really important to the institution. But I have to wonder if that's a good use of the talents of a neuroscientist.
Exactly. Maybe there are parts of it in evaluating candidates that her expertise is very important. But often so much, these hiring committees are doing also a lot of the administrative clerical work that doesn't need a science-based training. And so the organization is really not using that person's resources talents effectively. And it's dragging that person's career down as well. You know, we heard so many examples from lawyers who were involved in administrative details of coordinating the summer internship program. What she ought to have been doing is spending time with clients. And it wasn't that she had chosen to spend her time that way. It's that the firm had tasked her to do that. And our research really backs up the fact that our organizations task women, not men, to do this work.
And interesting enough, your research finds that women are just as likely to assign this work to other women.
Exactly. It's not that it's some evil male managers that are doing this, but it's all of us. It's men and women. And that's because we have the collective expectation that women will say yes to this work. And so if we want something done, we ask a woman. And it's not fair to the women, and it harms their careers.
So the other thing that often happens with a lot of women, not just myself, but plenty of them, is that there's work that we believe, sometimes justifiably, wouldn't happen if we didn't do it. And that brings me back to some of the things like birthday parties, bringing in cakes for people, celebrating colleagues. Sometimes if we were not the ones who did that, it wouldn't happen.
Right. And these are really important activities. There was a study last year by McKinsey and Lean In that found, they surveyed hundreds of employers in the United States. And what they found is that 87% of employers said those activities, like what you mentioned, having parties, activities that promoted employee well-being and health, right? And happiness. 87% of companies said that those were critically important to the organization. But only 25% said that they rewarded the people who did those activities that led to that better well-being and health of employees. So there's this gap between it being important but not being rewarded. And that is the gap where women are filling in. And so we're not saying that we should stop doing these activities. They're really important. But men can stop off at the bakery on the way to work and get cakes also, right? It's not hard.
But will they? I mean, that's the question. Unless, and I maybe this is what you're talking about in terms of organizational solutions. I'm thinking about a fundraiser that I organized every single year that became a company-wide effort. And if I didn't do that, then we wouldn't have been giving to that very deserving charity. So does at some point do the executives have to say, look, this is important to us and therefore this work must be done?
Absolutely. You know, it's a failure of leadership to just have those things slip through the cracks, right? If they're important, let's do them, but let's assign who does them fairly. So absolutely, these things need to happen. And so Celeste, if you're organizing the fundraiser this year, maybe then you don't have to do the set of other non-promotable activities that you were doing. Take those off your plate and give them to somebody else that isn't doing those activities. And so what we have to do is share this load, share it equitably across men and women, but also, as you started out talking about, looking at other aspects of identity. There's research that also shows that people of color get assigned to do these tasks more than people who are white. So that's also burdening people of color with this work, holding them back.
Sometimes the requests to do these things are couched in complimentary terms. What researchers like you call casual sexism, benevolent sexism, whatever term you want to use, where they ask the woman to take the notes by saying, you have the best handwriting in the group, or you do such a great job at this. How do we respond in those cases?
Yeah, I think that we respond by saying, well, that's great. I'll do it this week, but perhaps Ben can do it next week and he can take notes on his laptop since his writing is not so good, right? And have other people in the room to back it up. And this is one of the things that we've heard about in the Obama administration is that, of course, you've heard of the research that shows that when women present an idea, they don't get credit for it. But when a man then, the exact same idea, it's agreed by the group and gets credit for it.
Yeah.
So the women in the Obama White House were tired of this happening. And so they kind of got together and said, hey, look, next time we're in a meeting, a woman says something, it doesn't get noticed. Another woman will chime in and say, hey, Mary, that's a great idea, right? And or if Brad takes credit for it, she can chime in and say, oh, Brad, I'm so glad that you liked Mary's idea. That's right. And so you can kind of have this either explicit or implicit agreement among others in your team that you're going to chime in and support the suggestion, for example, to rotate these tasks.
You're listening to Women Amplified, featuring Linda Babcock, women's empowerment researcher and bestselling author. If you want to hear more from Linda, you're in luck because she's joining Selena Gomez, Jose Andres, Brene Brown, and many other speakers this fall at the Texas Conference for Women. Visit texasconferenceforwomen.org to learn more and register. As a reminder, you can always find additional resources and a transcript of each episode by going to our show notes page at conferencesforwomen.org/podcast. You will also find there links to our active communities on Instagram, Twitter, and more. We really hope you'll give Women Amplified a follow and tell us about the guests you loved or the episode that you would need to hear next. Now, though, let's get back to our conversation.
So if I am listening to you and I say, wow, Linda Babcock is right. I need to stop doing all this extra work that A, is leading to overwork and burnout on my part, but also is not helping me get ahead. So I'm all in. How do I go through my schedule and determine which ones are promotable and which ones aren't?
Well, I think there's a couple pieces to your question. And one is that we don't necessarily want to be advising that women just start saying no to this work without presenting alternatives, because there is the collective expectation that women will say yes to this work. And so there can be backlash against her if she does say no. And so that's why we're really trying to promote an organizational solution so that you're not putting women in this difficult position where either they're saying yes to the task and then they're dragged down by it, or no, and then there's backlash against them. But what we do suggest in the book is that women do take a look at their schedules just to get a handle on how much of this non-promotable work they're doing. And so we identify three characteristics of this work. First, it isn't directly tied to the organization's mission and goals. So for example, if you're a lawyer, bringing in a new client or logging billable hours are directly associated with the organization's mission. So that's promotable. Okay. And yet working on the program to hire the summer interns is not. Second, the work is typically invisible. So women engage in a lot of activities that are important to the organization, but not seen. For example, they help out each other a lot. Someone needs a report to be edited or help with a PowerPoint presentation. Women are often the ones stepping in to help, and that's done behind the scenes and so not visible. Women also are involved in solving a lot of interpersonal conflicts that happen at work. And of course, that also happens behind the scene. And so you're not going to get credit for work if it's not visible. The third characteristic of non-promotable work is that many people can do them, not just you. And we talked about this earlier. If you're having a scientist input data or take notes in a meeting, that may not be the efficient use of her time, not using her specialized skill. So if pretty much anybody in the organization can do it, it's probably not a promotable task. And so you can go through your tasks that you do every day, each week, each month, and rate them on a scale of promotability. You know, is this something that's really going to be noticed and appreciated and compensated? Or is this something that's done behind the scene, is less important to the organizational goals or less visible to the organizational goals that then is likely to be non-promotable?
Okay. So if this is not sort of an individual solution in that I find out I spend 90 minutes a day doing non-promotable tasks, and if my solution is not to walk in my boss and say, nope, not happening anymore, screw you, then how do I go about bringing about the organizational changes that you're talking about?
Well, we really recommend that women do take a look at their schedules so that they can help to raise awareness in their organization of what's promotable, what's not promotable, and the inequities in how these tasks are allocated in order to ready the organization for change. And so we think that people talking about this work is, you know, this is non-promotable, and starting to have those conversations, whether it be in book clubs, in affinity groups, that will then start to build momentum for organizations to make some systematic changes about how work is allocated. And so it's kind of a understanding my own situation so that I can bring awareness to this broader situation at work and be instruments of sparking the change for that organization, because this might be new thinking to many organizational leaders. And so sometimes change can bubble up from the bottom by people raising the issue, talking about it, and then creating that case for change.
That's an incremental strategy, though. I wonder what advice you have for a woman who, like so many others, is burnt out right now, for whom, you know, a very typical situation I will see is that a woman has all of these tasks that are non-promotable, but she doesn't want to let up on her promotable work. And so therefore, she ends up working a lot of hours, 60 hours or more per week in order to get it all done. That incremental strategy may feel too slow for her.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so there are other things that could be done. Talking to your boss, I read this book, I saw a talk about this work. It's interesting. I've noticed that women are assigned this work more. You know, how about us changing some of the ways that we allocate this work, you know, or doing these initiatives, you know, like I mentioned before, when someone's asking for a volunteer to just say, hey, how about we draw names out of a hat? And so that can start to create change. But I totally get the impatience of the slow approach. And you're right, because women's plates are filled up with this non-promotable work and they're working so many hours that also being a part of a change initiative feels a little daunting. And that's why we are engaging in a lot of media activities that's focused on the business press, so that organizational leaders see this work and realize it's an opportunity to change and make the organization more effective. And so we've targeted a lot of audiences like Fortune and Forbes, Fast Company, the Harvard Business Review, places where executives and organizational leaders read about the latest research, because we think that this could be an aha moment for them and help them to realize some of their goals by changing the way that this work is allocated.
Why is the business press so influential here?
Well, because it's targeting the people who have the power to make change.
And they read it, right?
Exactly. To read it and then say, you know, hey, we could have a competitive advantage by allocating our talent better. Hey, we haven't been achieving our equity goals. This might be one way to do it that's going to help the organization in multiple levels. And so organizational leaders are looking out for innovative ways to make change. And so we think that this will be very attractive for them in that it doesn't require complex organizational solutions.
So how important is this to a woman's career decisions? In other words, if a woman is in a position in which she is getting a lot of this work, she has tried to speak with supervisors, she tried to bring about change, and it hasn't worked, should she be looking for another position?
Well, this work has severe consequences for women. As our work is starting to get more attention in the media, I've often heard comments to some of these articles like, oh, well, so what if a woman has to go get cake and make coffee? This is no big deal. But what we found in one study is that women in an organization were spending 200 more hours per year than men on non-promotable work.
Oh my gosh.
200 more hours. Okay. And so what this adds up to is something we call work-work imbalance. So you've heard of work-life imbalance, but work-work imbalance is the balance between the kinds of work you do at work that is promotable and non-promotable. And when women's work-work balance is imbalanced, she's doing too much non-promotable work and not enough promotable work. And that has really severe implications for women. And let me just step back and tell you a personal story.
Yeah.
So I'm a professor at Carnegie Mellon, and our promotable work is research and teaching. And a lot of the other work that we do is called service. And this is the work that's important for the organization, but won't reward me for doing it. And I found that I was getting bombarded with requests to do this work. It's actually what started me on this research on this topic, was realizing that my schedule was completely out of control. And it had some really negative impacts on me. Because I had so much non-promotable work, I cut back on my promotable work. And I was really starting to feel, and the truth of the matter was, I was starting to be a lot less productive as a scholar. And it affected the way I felt about myself. I lost confidence that I still had what it took to succeed in academia, caused me a lot of stress. And I started really questioning my identity as a scholar. And I became really unhappy with my job. And many times I almost quit. It got to be pretty bad. And so I almost left a job that I loved at one point.
Wow.
And so this is not just getting cakes. This is really affecting so many parts of a woman's life. And so it's quite a serious problem. I do think that it forces many women to the point of quitting. And, you know, there's research on burnout that's showing that women are so much more burnout at work than men.
Yeah.
We think this is a big part of it. They're just dragged down by this work that forces many people to look elsewhere.
This has also, research shows, been the case in terms of racial equity and justice in the workplace, which leads us back to the comment you made earlier on the fact that very often the very people who suffer from inequities are the ones that end up having to do all the work to remedy it. Do you have any suggestions on how we might go about finding allies, especially those allies with lots of influence, who statistically speaking are likely to be white men?
Yeah, no, it's a really important question. You know, the survey that I mentioned earlier, 70% of companies said that DEI initiatives were really important to the company, but only 24% of those companies reward the people that work on those DEI initiatives. And who is tasked with engaging in those activities? People of color and women. And so you're giving them a supersized helping of non-promotable work that's going to further drag them down. So this is something we absolutely have to fix. And if organizations say, well, but those voices are really important in these initiatives, well, fine. Reward them for it. Make it part of their jobs. Make it part of their promotion possibility. Take other non-promotable work off their plates if they're doing DEI work. And so there's lots of ways to have the voices you want in these initiatives without taxing the people who do them. Because that's really what it is. You're taxing people for their underrepresentation. And that fundamentally isn't fair.
Okay. So have you seen some of your strategies implemented in a way that worked?
Absolutely. We've seen great success in small changes and in large changes. For example, my co-author Lisa works at another university. And the way they do promotions is that they have a big meeting and someone writes up the meeting notes after the deliberations. And that task typically went to women. It's really important for the organization, but it wasn't rewarded. And what they do now is they draw names out of a hat. They literally bring a hat into the meeting with people's names and they draw the name of the person who will write up the meeting notes. That's a small change and that can happen overnight. And that's something that she was really successful at changing the organizational culture so that it didn't overburden women. Now you can go on the other end of the spectrum. One organization that I was working with, I'd been down to give a talk to them and the timing of the talk was that it happened while they were revamping their performance evaluation system. And what they realized during my talk was that some of the things that they thought were really important to the functioning of their organization weren't being recognized in performance evaluations. And so they changed the way that they evaluated performance. They decided that helping other people was really important and they wanted to promote that. So what they did is that if you were helped by somebody, you could put a note in someone's file that says, hey, this person helped me on this project and here's why it was really valuable to me. And that those would be explicitly used as metrics, those notes in that person's performance evaluation. So you didn't have any, you didn't score well on that dimension and your raise was less. And so that's a kind of an example of a broader initiative that takes more planning and coordination, but still can change the way that people feel about doing this work that was previously non-promotable. In fact, you know, in a sense, they made the non-promotable work promotable.
So you've made the case, I think, pretty convincingly that making these kind of changes is really important for women, especially. But can you make the case for any executives who may be listening on why it's worth it? Because you look, it takes a lot of effort to make changes like this. What you're talking about is changing kind of the norms and culture of a business.
Mm-hmm. And clearly there is some low-hanging fruit, things that can be done easily. But the more kind of bigger changes does take organizational leadership to say, this is important and here's why. And so we actually have a whole chapter in the book that shows how the mismanagement of non-promotable work hurts the profitability of organizations. And that makes really the business case for it, that you're not using your talent effectively. You're having dissatisfied workers. That causes workers to quit. Quits are very expensive because you have to recruit and train new people. And so there really is a business case for better managing how this work is allocated and rewarded. So we think that that's something executives and leadership will pay attention to.
I agree. Any last bits of advice for all the women who may be listening and trying to screw up their determination and courage to take this on?
Yeah, definitely. The thing that was most helpful for me personally was not all the research that I did and the companies that I consulted for, but was my no club. So we started this club 12 years ago, five of us, who were all frustrated with our work lives in terms of we felt overwhelmed all the time and we didn't know why. And we've been meeting just about every month for 12 years. And it's through that process that we generated the research and this book. But on a personal level, the club has been incredibly helpful for us and supportive in that we can discuss how we're spending our time with a group of other people who are invested in our success and who will listen and not judge and help us try to make better choices ourselves in the areas that we can. And that club has been really a bedrock for me in turning around my career and my happiness. And I think other clubs around the country have formed. And this is something that you can do with a group of friends to see how this work affects you and what changes you can make in your own lives. Because we found that not only could we make some changes in our own work schedules, but we could have influence on our organization. So Lisa, when she suggested they draw names out of a hat, she had an influence. Lori, who's another one of my co-authors, changed the way that committee assignments were made because she made a spreadsheet showing how women were doing more committees than men, which is non-promotable in a university. And so they now track this with a spreadsheet. So these are the kinds of things that we as individuals came out of our club, not ways that we could personally change, but also ways that we could help our organizations change. So for us, it was just a very positive experience.
Great. I really appreciate it, Linda. Thank you so much.
Today's episode featured Linda Babcock, professor of economics at Carnegie Mellon, bestselling author of several negotiation books as well. And her most recent book came out in May. It's called The No Club, Putting a Stop to Women's Dead-End Work. It's about how men and women spend their time while they're at work. And you can purchase that book online at our bookstore. It's at conferencesforwomen.org. Also, to learn more about the incredible work she's doing around women's empowerment, register for the Texas Conference for Women taking place this fall. She will be speaking there. If you enjoy this podcast, please make sure to share it with others, rate it, and review it. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation. They draw more than 55,000 women and men to annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and California. To learn more about our 2022 events online and in person in Boston, Philadelphia, and Austin, please visit us at conferencesforwomen.org. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. As always, thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.